Hello, everybody. Dr. Ben Edwards here with another episode of You're the Cure. I'm super excited today to have a special guest, Dr. Peter McCullough, who I would consider to be the world's expert on COVID-19, probably the most cited publications on COVID-19 outpatient treatment for sure, no questions asked. But I would say he's an overall world's authority on it. And he's been very outspoken, even getting some conventional mainstream media time with Fox News. So I'm excited that Dr. McCullough is going to join us today and discuss where we are at with COVID-19 and discuss the entire past year and a half of what's now retrospectively looking back. Where could we have done things better and different, and where could we still going forward do things better and different? First, a little background. Dr. McCullough got his bachelor degree from Baylor University, completed his medical degree as an Alpha Omega Alpha graduate from University of Texas Southwestern Medical School in Dallas. And then he went on to complete his internal medicine residency at the University of Washington in Seattle, a cardiology fellowship, including service as chief fellow at the William Beaumont Hospital, also getting a master's degree in public health at the University of Michigan. Dr. McCullough is a consultant cardiologist and vice chief of medicine at Baylor University Medical Center in Dallas, and he's a principal faculty in internal medicine for the Texas A&M University Health Science Center. Dr. McCullough, thank you for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me. Just to clarify, I don't have any positions of authority at Baylor University Medical Center.
Okay. So from my point of view, Dr. McCullough, as I stated earlier, I would consider you one of the, if not the world's authority on COVID-19. I've heard others describe you as that also, but give our listeners a little bit of background on why one could say that, considering you're a cardiologist. And I will say, I didn't mention the most published cardiologist when it comes to your subspecialty of cardiorenal. So that's kidney disease with over 1,000 publications. What makes you the authority on COVID-19?
I was previously the chief academic and scientific officer for the major unit for Ascension Health. So I've been very involved academically throughout my career. I got a master's degree in public health from the University of Michigan. And since I've been back in Dallas, which is where I originated from, I've been a professor of medicine at Texas A&M College of Medicine. I'm in a large cardiology practice now, but I maintain my board certifications in internal medicine and cardiology. I'm the editor-in-chief of Cardiorenal Medicine, of Reviews in Cardiovascular Medicine. I'm the senior associate editor of the American Journal of Cardiology, which is edited on the Baylor-Dallas campus. And I'm very academically involved. I've published over 600 publications in the National Library of Medicine. They're cited there. I'm the editor-in-chief of the first textbook on cardiorenal medicine. And when COVID-19 hit, I saw this as an opportunity to really contribute to mankind and contribute to what turns out to be a really critical response to a very important world historical event. And after a first few weeks or months, I didn't see other people stepping up in one particular area, and that was outpatient treatment of COVID-19. Everybody was gravitating towards inpatient care and then protecting themselves, how to lock down, how to use personal protective equipment, and then when patients did come into the hospital, how to treat them. But no one was focusing on the acutely sick patient at home to reduce hospitalizations and deaths. So I said it at the time. I said, you know, this is our medical Super Bowl, and it's time to step up. And indeed, certain doctors did step up. I've spent more than a year now completely focused on COVID-19. In a sense, I've done an infectious disease fellowship. I've published 45 papers on COVID-19, including the two critical papers that teach doctors how to treat this illness at home to prevent two bad outcomes, hospitalization and death.
Yes, and I've been and my patients have been a benefactor of those publications. So I want to say thank you for that. How did you go about early on when you saw that the focus was not on early treatment, it was on personal protection and then hospital treatment? Where did you go to find your plan of action for the treatment?
I had just in the last year or so been over to Italy multiple times. I collaborate with the Italians really well. And I reached out to some key readers in Siena. Alberto Palazzoli was one of them. And we started communicating, what are you guys seeing? Because it looked like it jumped from Wuhan over to Milan, Tuscany and south of Milan. And immediately we started communicating on a daily basis almost about what was going on. And they reported to us, they said, listen, this virus is nothing to fool around with. It looks like it is amenable to risk stratification. It's pretty clearly severely affecting the elderly and those with multiple medical problems. It appears to almost do nothing to young people. And in those serious cases, there seems to be three important components to this: viral replication, cytokine storm or inflammation, and then thrombosis. In fact, when people die, they die of blood clots.
So from that point, and I'm just trying to paint this timeline because we're going to diverge off of what kind of the public health authorities have been stating. So I'm trying to paint the picture here. So early on, I'm talking the first few days, week or two. I mean, you're right in step with everything coming out as far as we don't know what this virus is. Let's lock down. Let's wear masks. Let's socially distance. Let's do these things. But then quickly you moved into how do we actually treat this, which is a logical step. Most doctors, I think, would agree that, yes, let's look at we all know, especially with viral illness, if you get on it early, but really any illness that ends up potentially in the ICU, early treatment is always the best option. So you pursued that. The Italians were giving you some information. So then you went to the literature and found where did the hydroxychloroquine come in?
You know, it turned out that the United States had stockpiled hydroxychloroquine, and we heard from a leader in France, Didier Raoult, and his companion, Matthew Million, in Marseille, that looked like hydroxychloroquine was working. They had opened up a field hospital there and had really thousands of French who were older French. If you've ever been down to Marseille, you know it's kind of the retirement area on the French Riviera, so they have a lot of elderly French. They were getting sick. And Rialt was reporting this, said, listen, hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin look pretty good. And this was presented on the U.S. media. It became confused. President Trump said, well, gosh, this could be potentially a game changer. It was quickly contorted and twisted. And before you knew it, we were kind of off the rails on hydroxychloroquine. I had already written the first investigation drug application with the FDA for hydroxychloroquine for a study that we did in Dallas to prevent COVID-19 in healthcare workers. And the FDA was great back in March. We got that done in a weekend and got it rolling. In fact, we treated hundreds of individuals in our healthcare centers at hydroxychloroquine safe and well-tolerated. But things really got off track. And by, I think it was June, there was a fraudulent paper published in Lancet that said hydroxychloroquine actually harmed patients, which in fact it didn't. Lancet let that hang out there for 2 weeks and scared people on hydroxychloroquine, and then it was retracted without any apology. And so I started to see things going on, and it was relatively clear by May or June that no one was really going to treat this illness as an outpatient. And I wasn't seeing any U.S. doctors step up. We saw some activity with the French. We knew about Vladimir Zelenko in Monroe, New York, who was working to treat some patients in upstate New York. And I said, that's it. We've got to do something, because we had 50,000 papers in the literature. Not a single one put a protocol together. We knew this is a fatal viral infection. Single drugs don't work. They don't. We don't do this for any serious viral or bacterial infection. We have to use drug combinations, especially since we had viral replication, cytokine storm, and thrombosis. There's no drug that's going to cover those three elements. So our breakthrough paper was published in August of 2020, the American Journal of Medicine, pretty highly ranked journal in the United States, and was a big group of authors, U.S. academic, community hospital doctors, Italians. And the title of the paper was The Pathophysiologic Basis and Rationale for the Early Ambulatory Treatment of COVID-19 to Reduce Hospitalization and Death. And it put the drugs together in sequence. To this day, it's the most frequently downloaded and utilized paper from the American Journal of Medicine. And then before you know it, we had great data supporting hydroxychloroquine, colchicine, and EUA monoclonal antibodies. So by December, in Reviews in Cardiovascular Medicine, a journal that I edit, I commissioned a separate dedicated supplement. That supplement had a separate editor. It went through very thorough peer review. And the second protocol paper came out. And now that paper is the most downloaded and widely utilized paper in all of outpatient COVID-19.
So not only have you published yourself, written and published numerous, you know, hundreds of medical research articles, but you're the editor of a couple of journals. You know how this process works. You're an academic physician. How can a paper get to the Lancet, a fraudulent paper, get to the Lancet in, I don't know what the time frame was, but it seemed like pretty short order. Yeah, and I know this is probably just opinion or opining, but can you give some thought? Because that's mind-blowing, I think, to people, especially to fellow academics, because the Lancet's a respectable journal. How do you think that happened?
It was the first, and this is very important for the listeners to understand, it's the hardest thing for Americans to stomach this, but it was the first in the sequence of events that's what's called malfeasance. Malfeasance is wrongdoing by those of positions of authority. Now, as an editor of two major journals, and I've done this for 20 years, I would never allow a fraudulent paper to be published in a journal and mislead the readership and mislead the world. That appears to be have done intentionally by Lancet. And then from there, the FDA based its recommendation from that paper to say, don't use hydroxychloroquine to treat COVID-19. Now, here we have a drug, as we sit here today, there's 200 supportive studies. There are prospective randomized trials done outpatient, large observational studies, some very small randomized trials as an inpatient basis that really aren't informative. A drug that's clearly safe, it reduces viral entry. It is a zinc ionophore, carries zinc into the cells to reduce the polymerase activity. And it's anti-inflammatory because we use it in lupus and rheumatoid arthritis. So here's a drug that's safe and effective, that's relied upon millions of times worldwide to treat COVID-19. And we see acts of malfeasance against hydroxychloroquine. And it doesn't stop there. There were reports of hydroxychloroquine being burned in pharmacies across Africa. Not being stolen, but burned. The second largest hydroxychloroquine plant outside of Taipei was mysteriously burned to the ground. The countries like U.S. and Australia stockpiled hydroxychloroquine, but didn't release it to the public. So there is a really building story of malfeasance, in fact, nefarious activity for an important drug like hydroxychloroquine.
It's really unbelievable. Yeah, I'm looking at a website right now, hcqmeta.com. People can go to and check it out. 265 different studies at this website alludes to. And of course, some of those studies won't be as strong, but there's plenty, like Dr. McCullough just said, plenty of randomized controlled trials and meta-analysis there. HCQmeta.com if listeners want to check that out. So back to your papers, the two most downloaded papers, Dr. McCullough, who do you think's downloading those? Because I think I've heard you in other interviews say that as far as you're aware, there's not one major academic institution, a hospital system in America that's utilizing this protocol.
You know, interestingly, we have 5,600 hospitals in the United States, 2,200 tertiary medical centers. We have about 300 medical schools. Do you know not a single one of those institutions has their own outpatient treatment protocol for COVID-19? That's a stunning observation that here we have a problem that's affected millions and millions of Americans. We've had 620,000 Americans lose their lives. And these medical centers have a goose egg. They have zero offering for outpatients with COVID-19. And it's actually worse than that because the government has pre-purchased 500 million doses of EUA monoclonal antibodies and started with the original product, the Lilly product originally, and then it's migrated to Regeneron and GlaxoSmithKline. These were EUA approved in November. 500 million doses of them. All the ERs and hospitals are outfitted with these monoclonal antibodies. And do you know, there isn't a single public service announcement telling our high-risk seniors how to access these antibodies. You know, hospitals are not messaging that they have these antibodies available. When people get a test result, they're not given any information sheet on where to go and get these antibodies. And they should wonder about it because President Trump got an antibody infusion himself. And I testified March 10th in the Texas Senate in 2021. And I basically said, listen, our Department of Health and Human Services has neglected sick patients with COVID-19. Where's the information on the monoclonal antibodies? Where's the Texas 1-800 number so people can get access to these? It's almost as if they're intentionally being blocked from getting life-saving therapy. The antibodies work fine. I make a call to our ER. They have spots all day long. We can have patients go in, get an infusion, get home. It's a great way to start the treatment program, and then we can use the oral drugs after that.
Right. Well, can you briefly walk through the protocol that's been published that attacks these three different avenues that the virus can injure people?
Okay, so people under age 50 basically don't need treatment. There are some nutraceuticals that are helpful, zinc, quercetin, vitamin D, vitamin C. They're perfectly fine. They can go to the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons, AAPS, online and download their home treatment guide. The treatment guide, by the way, incorporates the principles out of the papers that I've published, and that is the most widely downloaded, utilized treatment document that exists, been used, we think, millions of times and passed on to others millions and millions of times. It's a PDF document that has all the information. So on age under 50, nutraceuticals, ride out the infection. You know, I can tell you at my hospital, there was never any testing needed to return to work. As long as the fever has gone away, symptoms have reasonably resolved, go back to work. We know that young people, the period of infectivity is probably 4 days or less. Now, people over 50, medical problems, particularly seniors, they're going to need treatment. So everybody should stay at home, home quarantine, air out the house, start the nutraceuticals. I advise people actually sterilize surfaces in the house to reduce the viral contagion. So sterilize the things that you touch, cell phones, countertops, etc. People should take a shower twice a day with either Dial antiseptic soap or Hibiclens that actually have a sterilizing shower once a day. People, by the way, young people and older people, they should actually brush their teeth and swish and swallow with yellow Listerine. That actually kills the virus. There's other oral solutions that can kill the virus, including a dilute hypochlorite solution or povidone iodine. People can find these online. So there's a ways of actually dealing with oral health. Our dentists have been doing this all year long without much fanfare, and there's never been any dental outbreaks. But having said that, we do these good hygiene measures and we move into the drugs. Ideally, it would be a monoclonal antibody infusion followed by a course of hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin plus doxycycline or azithromycin that cover the virus. Okay, that's got to be done early. Day one, when it's very mild, if we treat it early, it's successful. We can't wait until people are a week or two into this and deathly ill. We got to start early. After that, we use inhaled budesonide. Richard Bartlett from Texas gets credit on discovering this. It was proven in a trial from the Stoic trial. Inhaled budesonide, 800 micrograms twice a day. Day five are pulmonary symptoms, more severe symptoms. We use prednisone, typically a five-day course. We use colchicine, a gout drug, all the way through for 30 days, one tablet a day. And then for serious patients, patients at risk for blood clotting, we get everybody on aspirin, full dose, 325 milligrams, at least 30 days, extended 90 days in seniors. And then my high-risk patients, I like to use Lovenox, injectable Lovenox, 80 milligrams twice a day, full dose. And that would be what's called sequenced multi-drug therapy for COVID-19. It is a winner. It takes about 4 to 6 drugs. Proctor and Zelenko have shown in their studies that we can reduce hospitalization and death by 85%. I've treated patients in their 90s with very sick patients and avoided the hospital completely. It's way better than ending up in the hospital. People in the hospital get put in isolation. In my view, the care is not optimal. They actually don't get access to these important life-saving drugs. And it can be a railroad. The vast majority of Americans that have lost their life to COVID-19 have lost it in the hospital.
Yeah. And for the listeners that aren't familiar with all these medications, I just want to reiterate that your doctor knows about these medications. Azithromycin, doxycycline, hydroxychloroquine, budesonide, that's a steroid. These are very, very common medications. We use them every day for other infectious diseases, hydroxychloroquine for different autoimmune diseases. So these are not unfamiliar. I would say every doctor, every primary care doctor would know about these, be familiar with these, be comfortable with these. So this isn't like we're just going out on this limb, you know, trying some crazy drugs nobody's heard of. That's the remarkable thing to me, Dr. McCullough, is these are common drugs. There's published data. There's a remarkable, I don't know of any other disease process where you can say there's going to be 85 to 90% reduction in hospitalization and mortality. If you start this early, this is an amazing, there's amazing data behind it. There's a nice little flow sheet and that doctors can download off aapsonline.org. I mean, it's what doctors love. We love protocols. We love these algorithms. We love flow sheets. I mean, you've got everything there, the dosing, it's right there. Is it just the peer pressure? Is it because these institutional authorities, CDC, WHO, NIH, what's holding these doctors back in your opinion? And I understand this is your opinion, but I mean, it's been over a year now. You published that first study in August of, and we're coming up on August of 2021 right now. So what do you think it is holding these doctors back?
Well, it's only holding some doctors back. So, you know, we're in Texas. If we want to fly a couple hours down to Mexico City, patients will get ivermectin hydroxy-based protocols all day long. We have very good data at Texas A&M. I'm a professor at Texas A&M. They've worked with a great study down in Honduras, and they're using these drug combinations again frequently. You don't hear about COVID-19 wiping out Central America. You only hear about problems with COVID-19 where they're not treating it correctly. So in the United States, the UK, the European Union, South Africa, Australia, where they're not treating it, it's been a mess. You don't hear about COVID-19 wiping out Russia or Eastern Europe. No, they have all these drugs. They're using these drugs wide open. They even have another drug called favipiravir. It's not such a great drug. It's kind of like a Tamiflu, but it's a Japanese product. They're using it in Japan, Russia, India. India is a great example. They had a big outbreak of Delta virus. They crushed it with early treatment. Mexico City crushed their curves. Peru and Chile have crushed their curves. So Americans should know around the world these drugs work, but there's something that's clouding the minds of American doctors where they're not even trying. They're not even trying to treat. Patients get a COVID-19 test result. They're not even given recommendations to take an aspirin for that matter. So Americans should ask themselves, what is in the minds of doctors that have created such confusion and what we call therapeutic nihilism? Therapeutic nihilism is basically the conduct of denying people treatment when they need it. And that's been going on in the United States now for over a year. It's probably the most disturbing thing I've actually ever seen in my life.
Yeah. Well, likewise, very disturbing for me. We have had a number of people come to our clinic who have told me that their doctor, this was earlier on in the pandemic, but their doctor just simply wouldn't see them, wouldn't treat them. They couldn't even go to their doctor's office. They weren't treating COVID. It was really shocking to me. And the only explanation I could come up with was these doctors must just be getting their information from some mainstream media sources that where it was not the full truth or all the data wasn't there. And perhaps fear set in amongst doctors, just as it had amongst everyone else in the world, it seems like.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. We'll have to do a deep dive on this. I think it'll probably be years later, almost like with Nazi war crimes, whether doctors were complicit or just woefully blind to it. I think there'll be an awakening where people will wake up and say, oh my gosh, what I did was horrible. I had people gasping for breath and I wouldn't offer even an ounce of treatment to them. And then they got railroaded into the hospital and got put on ventilators and they died. You know, we had 620,000 Americans cry out for help. The vast majority didn't get an ounce of treatment before the hospitalization. Yeah. It will go down. I think historians are going to write about this. What happened to American medicine? How did it get so off track? And how did so many good doctors turn bad so quickly?
Yeah. Well, speaking of Nazi war crimes, I think this is a good time to take a break because when we come back from the break, we're going to have to address the other side of this coin, the vaccine. And then that's in quotes because it doesn't meet the legal definition of what a vaccine is per the FDA and CDC. But this COVID-19 shot, very controversial. Initially, I know Dr. McCullough was recommending it for his patients, and I know now he's not. So we're going to ask him why that is when we get back from the break. And we'll take a deeper dive into that subject. Again, everyone, this is Dr. Peter McCullough that we're visiting with today. I would consider the world's authority and most published physician on COVID-19. I'm Dr. Ben Edwards at Veritas Medical in Lubbock, Texas, and you're listening to You're the Cure. Stick with us. We'll be right back. Okay, everybody, we are back. Thank you for joining us again today. We've got a very special guest, Dr. Peter McCullough. Talking COVID-19 outpatient treatment. I think in the first half of the show, we made a very good case for the fact that people don't need to be scared about COVID-19. And I would say never be scared of any virus. God's amazing design, your immune system's incredible if you'll just steward it the right way. Even Dr. McCullough said, if you're under 50 years old and relatively healthy, you don't need to worry. from my perspective, relatively healthy in America. There's a big asterisk there. I've talked to so many people that they think they're healthy, but their BMI is a little bit off. They have a little extra weight. They've got a little fatigue, a little bit of mild headache, a little reflux. You know, there's signs that things are not perfectly healthy, although they think they're okay. But even in that setting, under 50 years old, the standard American, who we're not the healthiest population in the world, you basically can breeze through this virus. With this outpatient treatment we've just laid out, 85% reduction in hospitalization and death. And that's even if you're elderly and you have multiple comorbidities, multiple other diseases. So the fear aspect, I think, can be just put to bed. And that's across the board. And unfortunately, fear has driven, I think, a lot of our policy decisions throughout this past year. And I think even driving people into this acceptance of an emergency authorized gene therapy, we're calling a vaccine, I feel like people aren't fully informed on it. And I base that off of talking with people when I explain to them the facts and even what's on the informed consent paper that they signed that I don't think they read or anyone really explained to them. And they're shocked when they actually hear the truth. And unfortunately, they oftentimes regret submitting to that, to be a part of that emergency authorized administrated vaccine. So Dr. McCullough, let's go back to earlier on, when the emergency authorization was approved by the FDA, these vaccinations were available. You were recommending them initially, is that correct?
I was the lead witness in the November 19th U.S. Senate testimony on a treatment of COVID-19. The last question our panel got was, doctors, do you have any comment on the COVID-19 vaccine? And our entire panel was completely silent. You could hear a pin drop. And the reason why we were silent is we simply didn't know. We had the weirdest report that these vaccines were tested in large numbers of people. And despite having a test positivity rate in labs of 5, 10, 15%, they reported rates of COVID-19 less than 1% for placebo, as well as in patients who received the vaccine. So it was the oddest thing. They had 90% efficacy, but rates way less than 1%. So we knew the vaccines, for some reason, just were going to have a low impact on the population. And then we saw the data play out. It was 2 months of follow-up, and patients volunteered. Most patients didn't ask me or you whether or not they should get the vaccine. They went out to vaccine centers and got the vaccine and came back later on and told us about it. So about 70% of my patients got the vaccine. If people ask me and say, doctor, which one should I get? I'd say, listen, I probably would wait for the J&J vaccine because it's a single shot and it doesn't involve this novel messenger RNA. And it turns out, as we sit here today, Johnson & Johnson per shot has the fewest number of safety events. There's far more with Pfizer and Moderna. But as things played out, what we knew is there was a problem. By January 22nd, the number of deaths exceeded the annual number of expected deaths for the U.S. vaccine programs. The normal expected number is about 158 across about 500 million shots. The COVID vaccines themselves, with only 27 million shots, had already hit 186 deaths. And sure enough, it skyrocketed from there. And so by the time we were easily into March and things started to catch up, I couldn't recommend it to individuals. And now I have to tell you, I think we're at the point we need to shut down the program. Depends how you look at the data, but we're easily at 5,000 Americans who have lost their lives just strictly in the United States. Other product data coming in, over 10,000 lives lost. Separate analysis showing 86% of the time, there's no other explanation. I mean, they literally die. 50% die within 48 hours of the shot, 80% die within a week. The mortality is stunning. There's over 400,000 certified safety reports to the CDC, including over 20,000 hospitalizations, heart attacks, neurologic damage, immune system damage, blood clots. We have FDA safety warnings, official FDA warnings for Pfizer, Moderna for heart inflammation, myocarditis, damaging the hearts of kids, causing heart failure and cardiac death. We have official FDA warnings on J&J for blood clots in women age 18 to 48, as well as Guillain-Barré syndrome or paralysis. I mean, these vaccines clearly are unsafe and they need to be taken off the market.
I agree 100%. When I testified at the Texas Senate a few months ago reported to VAERS, the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, was just a skosh over 4,000 deaths at that point. And as of last Friday, which we're recording this on July 20th. So as of last Friday, it was just under 11,000. If you would have told me 6 months ago that we'd be sitting here this summer talking about, you know, 5,000 or maybe 10,000, maybe more. I know Thomas Rentz, an attorney, just filed a motion or a lawsuit in Alabama I believe it's a CDC whistleblower affidavit of 45,000 deaths. So, but anywhere in there, from 5,000 to 45,000, if you would have told me that we're going to sit here and talk about this, this number of deaths, and that everyone's not calling for it to be stopped, I would have thought you were crazy. But here we are. So let's break this down a little bit, because I really want the listeners to understand the two issues. And to me, it's efficacy and then safety. So when you mentioned this earlier, that initial efficacy, and I want the listeners to really hear this, those initial reports out of Pfizer, the data that they submitted to the FDA to get emergency authorization, most of the people didn't come into contact with COVID-19. Both the placebo group and the vaccinated group, it was less than 1% of the people who reported getting COVID-19, correct, Dr. McCullough?
Right. It was less than 1% in placebo and in active treatment.
So just from try to explain to the layperson, from an academic's point of view, on any therapy that you're testing, if there's less than 1% effect in both placebo and treatment group, and just in general, what would an academic researcher consider that is powerful, not powerful, you know, complete waste of time, or what are we talking here?
What people wanted to know with the vaccine is, if they got confronted with COVID-19, let's say in a waiting room or in a bus or an airplane, if they were challenged with COVID-19, would the vaccine protect them against getting COVID-19? And so with these less than 1% rates, we had no idea whether or not they would actually protect patients. All we knew is numerically, there were fewer cases of COVID-19 in the vaccine compared to placebo. There was no difference in hospitalizations and deaths because there were very few of them. Then the vaccines came out. Then we started seeing reports. One of the first ones came out of Denmark, big nursing home study, where it looked like the vaccines were about 90% protective in the nursing home workers who were younger. However, in the sick elderly patients, only about 70% protective. Then we saw a report from Johnson & Johnson out of South Africa, where the South African variant, so-called beta variant, it only was about 50% protective. So now we knew we were in trouble with AstraZeneca down in South Africa. And then it took off from there. We had the Sinovac vaccine came out, CoronaVac, which is a killed viral vaccine that was started in India. Then suddenly we had the emergence of the Indian variant that just overwhelmed that vaccine, and the Indian outbreak took off. Then we had the Sinovac down in Peru. And in Peru, we had an immediate explosion of the Lambda variant. And so an analysis has come out of Mayo Clinic, very important analysis, Mayo Clinic in Boston, saying when we get to 25% of the population vaccinated, we're just going to promote mutant strains. It's like putting everybody on a narrow spectrum antibiotic. We're just going to promote resistance. And in fact, that's what's happened. So we reduce the number of different strains of the virus, and we're creating these hyperdominant strains that are resistant to the vaccine. So current one is the Indian variant, and it looks like it's completely resistant to Pfizer, Moderna, and AstraZeneca. We don't know yet about Johnson & Johnson. So the Delta variant now has basically rendered the vaccines obsolete. They don't work.
Yeah, and I saw some data out of Israel, which Israel was very, very aggressive in their vaccination program. I think upwards of 80 to 90% of the population vaccinated, and I believe 80% of their current COVID cases are the Delta variant. Is that correct?
Yeah, so what we know out of Israel, which is doing fair reporting, that they're at about 75% of the population vaccinated over age 20. They have not vaccinated the children. 75% of adults. We know that 80% of those with COVID in Israel have been fully vaccinated. We assume it's the Delta variant. Now, Israel at its peak was getting about 10,000 cases a day. It's only 1,000 cases a day, so it's coming from a very low baseline. But it looks like the Pfizer vaccine, which they used exclusively in Israel, has completely failed. And now there's a report out today that 60% of those who are hospitalized have been fully vaccinated. Out of the United Kingdom, which is doing fair reporting as well, this was on Tucker Carlson last night. They had the UK health official on. 40% of those in the hospital have been fully vaccinated, either with Pfizer, Moderna, or AstraZeneca. So it looks like all three of those vaccines are failing. And we know in the UK, over 90% of cases are the Delta variant. In the United States now, we're over 50% Delta variant, and we can expect the vaccines to fail in the United States. It was a plane load of legislators that were all fully vaccinated on a plane, and they rode together, and six of them got off the plane and actually developed COVID-19. They had exposure to Kamala Harris, the vice president. She had been fully vaccinated, rushed her off to Walter Reed Medical Center. So I think basically Americans are learning that the vaccines, it's become known now in the last couple of weeks, the vaccines have failed.
Yeah. And I think just from a layman kind of standpoint, people can think about even the flu vaccine. Some years it's more effective, some years less effective, because influenza mutates and changes and there's different strains all the time. Some are more transmissible, some less transmissible, some more lethal, some less lethal, but they're always changing over time. And there have been some scientists who have stated that vaccinating a population in the middle of a pandemic pressures this virus to mutate more aggressively and to a more transmittable strain. Is that how you see it also, Dr. McCullough?
Yes, although the transmissibility is always determined from in vitro testing. So they take a cell culture and they see if the virus can more readily affect the cell. I don't think this transmissibility applies to people or populations because there's so much herd immunity now. If someone has had the COVID-19 virus, they can't get it a second time. So, you know, I've had COVID-19. I could walk right up to a patient with Delta, for instance. They could cough in my face and nothing would happen. So we know that someone who has had natural immunity, they can't get it. It's not true with the vaccine. If you had a vaccinated patient walked up to a Delta patient and got coughed in the face, they're probably going to get Delta. So what's preventing the spread is natural immunity, herd immunity. And I testified in the Texas Senate March 10th that we are at 80% herd immunity. So this is an important point. It doesn't mean that we're not going to have any cases. It just means it's not going to spread very far because there's so many people not susceptible. And that didn't calculate any vaccine impact. That was just from natural immunity.
Right. And I think it's noteworthy here to mention, if you've had COVID-19 naturally and fought it off and you've developed natural immunity, as I have, as Dr. McCullough has, you have this immunity now probably for life, but definitely immune to the variants. But if you choose to get this emergency authorized COVID shot, you increase your risk. There are three different studies that show increased risk of adverse events if you already have natural immunity. And that's something I don't think anyone's talking about loudly enough. It would be simple to screen these folks, and we'll talk about in a minute, these kids going back to college. But I don't really hear anyone talking about screening prior to vaccination and natural immunity in general. I don't hear much about.
Well, there are demand letters into the CDC, legal demand letters, demanding recognition of natural immunity. Natural immunity is far superior to vaccine immunity. And you know, there's never been a single case of a well-documented person who had COVID who got a second well-documented infection. I mean, with confirmatory testing, sequencing, antigen, PCR. There's been a couple false positive, you know, on one occasion or another, but natural immunity is perfect. But with vaccine immunity, you know, by the end of May, we already had 10,000 breakthrough cases just with the Pfizer, Moderna, J&J, and the UK variant that was largely the predominant variant in the United States. Now with Delta, it's blowing past all the vaccines. So vaccine immunity clearly is inferior to natural immunity. And I have never recommended somebody who has natural immunity who's had COVID-19 to get the vaccine ever. And you're right, three studies show harm. And I think it's another act of malfeasance that our CDC, NIH, FDA have not recognized natural immunity. In fact, our director of the National Allergy and Infection Branch has said on public TV that vaccine immunity is better than natural immunity. That is completely incorrect. That is a fraudulent statement. And the idea that somebody who's naturally immune should undertake the vaccine or be forced into it is completely against all tenets of science and of clinical judgment. And quite honestly, it's just wrong.
What would you say to the statement, Dr. McCullough, that someone sent me a news clip? Basically, it said the new pandemic is an unvaccinated pandemic, trying to blame unvaccinated folks for rising cases. Do you have a comment about that?
That is another act of malfeasance or fraud, and it's being conducted by our CDC. In the end of May, the CDC was so flooded with these vaccine failures, they announced they will no longer report vaccine failures, period. So they announced to the world they're only going to report COVID-19 and unvaccinated people. So when that happens and we get the next report of COVID, and then our federal agencies say, well, COVID is only occurring in unvaccinated people, or we have a crisis in unvaccinated people, including our president and administration officials said that yesterday, these are acts of fraud. In fact, we are loaded with vaccinated patients having COVID-19, just like Israel and the UK is. I have these people in my practice right now. So it's an act of fraud to represent that to the American people that only the unvaccinated are getting COVID-19. In fact, the rate of vaccine failures is going to be the proportionate to the number of people vaccinated in the United States. We're about 50% of people who rushed to get the vaccine. Many of them are regretful they did. And we got 50% of Americans that basically now don't want the vaccine. Vaccine centers are empty now for months. So anybody who's not gotten the vaccine right now doesn't want it. And they don't want it for good reasons. Either they've recovered from COVID-19, they know the vaccine doesn't work, or they know the vaccine's unsafe. So they don't want the vaccine for good reasons. And now we're facing with this situation where they feel uncomfortable because they feel as if someone's forcing them to take something they don't want.
So I would encourage listeners, if you're listening to any news program that states the vast majority of new cases or hospitalized cases or deaths even are in unvaccinated, I would switch the channel. I would get your news from somewhere else because it's just not based in the truth. Dr. McCullough, if for a minute, real quick, could you just opine on, because we don't have long-term safety data, so it will be opinion, but some educated guess, and I'm thinking more with young people in particular, for instance, fertility, antibody enhancement for down the road when coronaviruses naturally emerge again, maybe autoimmune disease, just any opinion or thought you have on potential future complications that we simply don't know because we don't have the data.
Well, Americans should know that the vaccines were not thoroughly tested. They were developed off failed biotechnology platforms. The messenger RNA and the adenoviral DNA platforms have been around for decades, and they've never worked out for gene transfer treatment. So treatment of heart failure or Fabry's disease or cancer. And so we know by the prior development that these vaccines stay in the body for months, if not longer. They're not in there for a day or two. So that's the first thing that's concerning. We should understand the vaccines have a dangerous mechanism of action. They genetically trick the body into making the dangerous spike protein. The spike protein injures cells, causes an immune attack against our organs, and then the spike protein freely circulates in the body, damaging blood vessels, causing blood clots, and damaging organs. So we should know right now these vaccines are dangerous biologically to the human body. Now, millions of people have taken the vaccine have done fine. Why? Because they probably had very little uptake of the vaccine into their cells. Hopefully, they got some benefit out of it and they're done. But for the unlucky people who their bodies take up a lot of the genetic material, watch out. Like I say, we've seen this terrible set of mortalities. It looks like the vaccines kill patients within 24 hours. They clearly cause neurologic abnormalities, heart damage, myocarditis. They clearly cause immune and blood system abnormalities. And in a paper by Rose and colleagues in the American Journal of Public Policy and Law, she demonstrated that these non-fatal things tend to skew towards younger people who don't need the vaccine anyway. You know, I've never recommended to people under age 50 in my practice to get the vaccine. Why? Because there's less than a 1% risk of hospitalization and death with COVID-19, and the natural immunity is better. But for young people now, to take the vaccine and have a few of them be subject to these unnecessary risks is unacceptable.
No, I completely agree. And the data you just said, you know, less than 50 years old, less than 1% chance of mortality, that's really without outpatient treatment, because the vast majority of the medical centers aren't using or weren't using that. So when you combine the fact that there's very, very low mortality in the young, plus the very effective treatments, which actually should disqualify any emergency use authorization from being given, because that's only should be given when there's no treatments, no therapies. That's another discussion, though. But when you combine those two things, to have a young person, especially a child, you know, this 12 to 17 year old group, the data that came out this past Friday, 14,003 total adverse events, including 866 rated as serious events. These are in teenagers and young people aged 12 to 17. 14 reported deaths, and this is all coming from VAERS, a 13-year-old boy with a previous history of COVID. So there you go. He already had natural immunity. He got the vaccine. He suffered a cardiac arrest and died 17 days after vaccination. Two 13-year-old boys died after the Pfizer vaccine, three 15-year-olds, three 16-year-olds, three 17-year-olds. All the VAERS IDs, I'm getting these from childrenhealthdefense.org. You can go check it out yourself. And my point is, even if it's 1 out of 1,000, 1 out of 10,000, 1 out of 100,000, whatever it is, I don't think, I mean, all these are senseless and needless deaths and injuries in these young people in particular. Just really mind-boggling. I've got 6 kids. The oldest one's 17 years old. Dr. McCall, I know you've had some college-aged kids. I've had a number of people reach out to me really out of desperation for help in writing letters or giving references and data to support their stance on behalf of their child who's trying to return to college this fall. And the demand to be vaccinated, not just a demand, but there's just coercion. I've looked at emails. I've been sent emails with flyers and basically these campaigns, these marketing campaigns to encourage these college kids to get vaccinated. It's like nothing I've ever seen before. And it's just this cognitive dissonance. How could this be? We've got really no benefit at all, definite risk in a population of young people like this. And it's being pushed by the authorities, by the presidents of the universities, by the board of regents, by whoever the administrators are. So we've got, you know, 5-10 minutes left in the interview. I'd like to kind of focus on that and get your opinion. Say your child was returning to a university this fall, where the demand was get a vaccine or else be tested, have a PCR test every week, all semester long, and or wear a mask or whatever other tactics they're going to use. Do you have some comments about that?
Well, the vaccine mandates that the CDC, NIH, and FDA workers are not taking the vaccine. They are not mandated to take the vaccine. The consent form says on the consent form that this is voluntary. It's completely elective. The consent form says we don't know if the vaccine is going to work and we don't know if it's safe. So anybody mandating a student to look at that consent form, right then and there, there's a full stop. The student's going to look at it and say, listen, it's elective. You can't mandate me to do something elective. They can take the consent form right back to the administrator. So you can see right now the mandates aren't going to work. And students have already paid their tuition. They're going to look at the consent form. They can walk that right into administration and say, well, what do I do with this? This is elective. You can't mandate something that's elective. And then we go on beyond that. Of course, it's research. It's investigation. So it violates the Office of Human Research Protections to have any pressure, coercion, or the threat of reprisal of any type to force somebody to be involved in a clinical investigation. So we have the U.S. Office of Human Research Protections. We have the Americans with Disabilities Act, which is a medical act that says, listen, you can't make somebody do something medically unsafe. And then we have Title VII, which says, based on ethical and religious directives, that you can't force somebody to do something against their will. So at this point in time, I think the students, if they want to take the vaccine, they can out of their own pure elective choice. But beyond that, they file a ADA, or they file a Title VII exemption. And if it's not accepted, they show up anyway and just show up under dispute. They can file letters of intent to sue the university for violating their rights. They've already paid the tuition, so many students are just going to show up anyway and say, sorry, I'm a student here and I've already paid tuition. You can't do anything about it. So I think the university mandates is a lot of bluster. I don't think anything's going to happen. I think these administrators are going to walk a walk of shame that they did this, that they mandated something elective. Do you know most of these universities, the professors aren't taking the vaccine? Do you know most of these universities, they don't even have policies or fair exemption processes? They are going to be, we're going to look at these, historians are going to look at this and look at the board of directors, look at the board of governors of these universities, look at the materials that they were using to threaten and to coerce. And they're going to be shamed for a vaccine that doesn't work and that's not safe and that the professors aren't going to take. There's only 9% of universities that are requiring the vaccine right now. And those 9%, I think, are going to be in the hall of shame of educational history in the United States. And I think shame on them for not having the perceptiveness and the decency and the ethical and moral standing to steer clear of this.
Do you think these university administrators, presidents, board of directors, are they just listening to conventional mainstream news outlets, CDC? I mean, are they being, I know this is again opinion, but it seems like it doesn't take a whole lot of digging to find you. I mean, you've been out there giving interviews, it seems like 10 interviews a day, and God bless you for doing it. I don't know how you must not sleep, Dr. McCullough, and thank you for all those interviews. But you've been out there. There's others out there. There's the frontline critical care doctors with Dr. Pierre Corey. He's been out there hammering the ivermectin. The data's out there. There's plenty of alternative media that's talking about it. Are they just scared that it's a quote-unquote conspiracy theory? Or I mean, and probably this will wrap up the show just in general, because I think this really points to the whole past year and a half, when the data was pretty clear on masks not working and social distancing, which I don't want to spend time, you know, hashing through that. But the data just keeps coming out showing, you know, hydroxychloroquine works, ivermectin works. There are certain strategies that do work and there are certain ones that don't. And it's just like, I've heard you say doctors are in a trance. And literally, that's probably the best explanation I could come up with too. These, from doctors to administrators to government authorities, it's crazy. And maybe, you know, this is really going out on a limb and maybe you don't want to go there, but I just read a story about some malware that was put on cell phones of these various world leaders and corporate leaders. And from a blackmail standpoint, I mean, who knows? I start grasping for some of these explanations because it just doesn't make sense to me. But anyways, any thoughts that maybe could help the listeners wrap their head around, like say the president of a university is even listening to this, you know, how could they go against all their other university presidents or the mainstream? You know, how could this really be that Dr. McCullough is correct and that all these other agencies are wrong? I mean, is there something behind this? I have my opinions from a spiritual perspective, good and evil, God and Satan. And that's probably where the conversation would go. But any closing thoughts from that standpoint?
I would use the term willful misconduct. Willful misconduct. So any university administrator that's going to take an investigational, genetic, unproven, ineffective, unsafe vaccine and force that on their students is committing willful misconduct. So that individual, that the university president or provost, the board of directors and governors, they actually have to answer for that. And I can tell you, historians, as well as medical professionals, starting with me and you, are not going to be very kind to them. They are going to face some of the most severe punishment they could ever imagine in their lifetime. There are cases filed right now of crimes against humanity. As these college students start to die and become injured and have their organs injured, I have one right now, a wonderful young man who's trying to be a student up in Denton, at North Texas State, and he's got an awful case of myocarditis. He may end up being a heart failure patient. The officials who are prompting this or pressuring this are going to be held accountable. The parents are going to have multi-million dollar, $100 million suits against universities. Their liability coverages are going to be exhausted. The students and parents have already told you they don't want it. So when you force something against somebody's will and something bad happens like a death, I will promise you these parents will sue. And it's going to be just a few short months, and we're going to see the debacle of the university vaccine mandate. That we're going to see it. It's going to be wide open, and it's going to be on the news. It's just that all we can tell people is I was on Tucker Carlson in May telling as loudly as I could, don't do it. Don't mandate these vaccines. Don't do it. It's a bad idea. And sure enough, about 9% of universities are doing it. The other ones aren't mandating it. They're wrongfully encouraging it. Can you imagine? There's promotional brochures of colleges saying, listen, just get the shot. Just do this, what have you. And these kids developing either dying or developing organ damage, the parents could even take those materials and say, I was encouraged or pressured to take the vaccine, and now I'm going to go ahead and file a lawsuit for damages against the university, and they should win those cases over and over again.
Yeah, and I would encourage parents out there listening to take this interview and send it to those administrators in love. I mean, hopefully it would be in love. I know we're getting to the point of such division and such emotion in the country, but I would still err on the side of let's just educate our fellow brothers and sisters in Christ out there. Educate them in love, expose them to the truth. Maybe they haven't been exposed to it, and give them this interview. And then they can do their own due diligence also, and parents can rest easy. And I would even encourage parents, if they have to get the lawyer and get aggressive, do it. I was just got off the phone with a lady who's had to retain the services of an attorney just to try to get therapy for her mother, who's in the ICU in a hospital in Texas. So you do what you have to do and bring the attorneys in, you know, when needed. Unfortunately, that's where we're at. Okay, Dr. McCullough, thank you for all you've done. I know you've put so much effort and really put your professional and probably even your personal reputation on the line, standing up for the truth. I don't really hear many other doctors doing that, especially in the position that you've been in. I can't imagine the pressure and the peer pressures. But I think you and I have this commonality of the truth. We're going to stand up for the truth no matter what. And I'm not saying these other doctors don't, but there is the pressures that people, human beings, succumb to pressures, whether it's fear of losing their job, fear of losing income, fear of losing their status or all they work for in their whole life, or just being looked at differently by their peers in the doctor's lounge or whatever it is. Or maybe it's just a true fear because they haven't taken the time because they're too busy and they haven't gone to dive into the research. But I think God's appointed you at this time in our history, and historians will look back, I think, and I would say even award you the Nobel Peace Prize because of the stand you took based in science and truth and love, and you got out there despite the potential for persecution, and you stood for all these folks who really are just so many patients out there. They just don't know. They've trusted their doctor. They've trusted these government agencies forever, and they just listen to the news. And you know, if it weren't for voices like you, I don't know where we'd be. So thank you for all you've been doing.
Well, thank you so much. And let me just say in closing, people ask me that a lot. They say, has anybody attacked you, or has anybody challenged you? I can tell you to this day, not a single person has challenged me. Not a single person has questioned my authority. In fact, people look incredibly fearful. And every single doctor who has denied care to a patient, and every single doctor who has promoted the vaccine and let the vaccine injure their patients, when they look at me, I see shame in their eyes and I see fear in their eyes. Not a single person, publicly or professionally, has had any degree of courage to approach me on this. And I can tell you, that is a testimony to what's going on. This is a crisis of compassion. It's a crisis of fear and of doubt in people's minds. They actually don't know what's right and wrong right now. Doctors have lost their way, and it's pretty obvious.
Yeah, I agree. Unfortunately, I think the profession of medicine has taken a major step backwards. but there is a remnant of physicians, and I'm proudly associated with them around the country, who are standing out and treating these patients, and their doors are open and have been open and will continue to be open. And thank you for connecting us all. You've performed a great service as a leader in the profession, connecting a lot of us doctors together on these COVID-19 task force and different groups online. So thank you again for all you do.
Thank you.
Okay, guys, just one last bit of encouragement. I know we have a lot of new listeners, so they may not be familiar with my background. I just wanted to remind folks that I'm a conventionally trained medical doctor, UT Houston Medical School. I did Baylor undergrad and Waco family practice residency training, where I was chief resident. I spent 7 years out at the Garza County Health Clinic in Post, Texas, being a small town country doctor like my granddad's. Both my granddads are small town docs. One of my granddads was a regent at Baylor even for a number of years. So I'm as conventional as it comes. But about 9 years ago, I was introduced to integrative medicine. Most conventional and Western minded folks don't know what that means. I didn't either. But what it means is you can integrate in other modalities that can be beneficial to a patient's healing. And most of these modalities are natural, meaning you can't patent them. And unfortunately, I didn't learn about most of these during medical school. But that doesn't mean they're not beneficial. And what I've learned over the years is actually the body knows exactly what to do all by itself, how to heal a paper cut, how to heal your broken bone, but also how to lower your blood sugar all by itself and lower your blood pressure all by itself and get your stomach acid at the right level all by itself and do everything all by itself. It wants to and knows how to function normally. And all these diseases we've seen crop up over the last 100 years are just that. They're modern diseases. Weston A. Price was a dentist in the early 1900s. And he noticed an uptick in these chronic diseases like arthritis, heart disease, and cancer in Cleveland, Ohio, where he had a practice. So he and his wife decided to travel the world and find people groups who were not succumbing to these diseases. And he found them all over the world, 14 different people groups over 20 years. And what he noted was when Western food came in, which meant processed flour and processed sugar, when that came into a people group around the world, whether it's through a missionary or just through the seaport where a ship would bring it in from the West, that's when chronic disease started to move in. Most people don't realize the first heart attack ever reported in the American medical literature was in 1912, when there was one heart attack in the entire medical literature in the United States. And now heart disease is the number one killer, with over 650,000 people going to die of heart disease. This is a new modern disease process. And all these diseases, obesity, diabetes, hypertension, all of it, all the autoimmune diseases, they are rooted in the diet and the lifestyle. And when we get diet and lifestyle right, our internal mechanisms work better, including the immune system. And that's why we preach the terrain theory trumps the germ theory, and the terrain theory trumps the gene theory. The bad cancer genes, they stay turned off unless your diet and lifestyle produces so many free radicals in the mitochondria that it turns them on. And that's what the medical literature is clear about, even though it's not taught or spoken of. But this is why Weston A. Price found that tuberculosis was ravaging certain villages. And right down the road, tuberculosis wasn't a problem at all. In fact, he called it tuberculosis resistance. Certain villages didn't succumb to tuberculosis at all, and other villages did. And what was the difference? Modern food. Processed grain and processed sugar shut down the immune system big time, as does stress. Dehydration and lack of movement. Sitting in a chair all day kills the immune system. Sitting's the new smoking. So be encouraged. Just the basics. It seemed too simple. They work. They work to reverse and prevent chronic disease, but they also work to boost the immune system so that you can walk through COVID and all the Delta and what other ever variants are going to come. Doesn't matter. The immune system's got you. Can't improve on God. God's immune system is beautiful if you steward it right. So be encouraged. Don't walk in fear. Fear turns the immune system off, probably more than sugar, more than sitting, more than dehydration. Fear. So keep walking it out in truth, peace, and love. The Bible's true. God's true. God loves you. He designed you beautifully. Nutrition, hydration, movement, and peace. The Veritas Four Pillars of Health. Go do it. Be well. Go be who God made you to be. Tune in next week for another great show. Bye-bye.